My name is Fred Niedner, and the title of this session is Betrothal Meals and Wedding Feasts. And we'll begin with a brief word of prayer. Lord, our Creator and Redeemer, we give thanks once again for a new day of life and ask that in this day you be with us in all that we do and say, and especially in this hour as we study the Scriptures, help us to see with gratitude the great price that you have paid in your Son, Jesus Christ, for the relationship of love and forgiveness and cherishing us as your own people, which we have each day under the baptismal grace we all live in. Help us to live out your love in relationship to each other, to ourselves, to our family members. In Jesus' name, amen. I have a commercial to begin with. First of all, the tape ministry people ask that we remind you that tapes of all sessions are available not only in the library for you to listen to while you're here, but if you speak to the people at the bookstore, you can purchase tapes of sessions that you may want to take with you and have recordings of for your own. Secondly, teaching staff are invited to recommend books of various kinds for the bookstore to order for purchase. In my last session on Wednesday, I used a book called Rachel about the biblical figure of Rachel, and it included some Midrash material which I shared. A Midrash is a story about a story, or an investigation into a story of the Bible. And I have recommended another book of Midrashim. Midrashim is the plural of Midrash. Entitled, Does God Have a Big Toe? It's billed as a children's book. It's a book of stories about stories in the Bible, mostly coming from Genesis and Exodus and a couple of others. But I guarantee you these are not just for children. These are stories that investigate little features of biblical stories, which I find most enlightening and enjoyable. And Mark Gelman, the author of these Midrashim, is a rabbi in New York who's also something of a celebrity because of a television show he does with a Roman Catholic priest weekly and talks about religious issues. But if you would like some fun with the Bible, I recommend Does God Have a Big Toe? All right, I've been starting with hilarity, or what I consider hilarity, in these sessions. And I brought stuff from my files along with me, and I have two sessions left and three things to choose from. One of them is something that a student gave me off the internet, which is about 40 different ways you can tell if you're still a redneck. Another one is the chain letter of Paul the Apostle to the Corinthians. And the other one is excerpts from a politically correct Bible. And I decided that I would just share a couple snippets of that with you. And this is sort of under the rubric that you can poke a little fun at almost anything. So these are just a couple of snippets from the politically correct Bible. A story of a healing from Matthew 12. And behold, there was a person who was manually challenged, and they asked Jesus, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Not that there was anything particularly wrong with him in the first place, mind you. So that they might accuse him of bias against the differently abled. He said to them, what person of you, if he or she has one sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value is a sheep than a man? Though people have rights too. So it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then he said to the person, stretch out your hand, and the person stretched it out, and it was temporarily abled like the other. This is the transfiguration from Mark 9. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Shabbaz, James, and Joan. In this Bible, disciples are a little different group. and led them around to the other side of a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them, and his garments became glistening intensely black, then changing unto brown, then red, then yellow, then lavender, as no fuller on earth could dye them. And there appeared to them Moses and Miriam, and they were dialoguing with Jesus. And Shabazz said, "Comrade, it is well that we are here. Let us establish 3 scholarship endowments, one in your name and one for Moses and one for Miriam." And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice with no particular accent came out of the cloud. "This is my beloved child. Listen to it." And as they were coming back around to the other side of the mountain, he suggested that they tell no one what they had seen until the child of person should have risen from among the ontologically challenged. I just love that, the ontologically challenged. Yeah. Well, here's just a couple of other snippets of this. They came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples, a great multitude, Bartimaeus, a visually challenged welfare recipient, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside, and when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, child of David and Michael or Bathsheba or Abishag, have solidarity with me." And Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." And throwing off his mantle, he sprang up with great agility, unmatched by most sighted folk, and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" And the visually challenged person said to him, "Comrade, affirm me in my differently abledness." And Jesus said to him, "Go your way. Your attitude has proven your wellness. Indeed, you are weller than the rest of us." And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon, the dermatologically challenged, the leper, as he sat at table enjoying a vegetarian meal, a woman came with an alabaster jar of ointment of pure perfume, very costly, and she broke the jar and poured it over his head. But there were some who said to themselves indignantly, "Why was the ointment thus wasted? For this ointment might have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And they reproached her. But Jesus said, "Of course, you're right. What was I thinking of?" That wasn't quite the end. "Of course, you're right. What was I thinking of? Here, let's see if we can scrape some of it up." Well, like I said, it's... you can poke fun at almost anything if you take it to its logical extreme. Wedding or betrothal meals and wedding feasts is the theme. Under the general rubric of foretastes of the feast to come, it would be a shame not to look at marriage and betrothal imagery, because that kind of imagery is very important in the biblical tradition. For talking about the relationship of God and God's people, and especially the consummation of that relationship in the feast to come. That marital imagery of God and God's people is all over the place in the Hebrew Bible. Most of the places are places where the marriage is not working. Hosea 1-3 is the most elaborate instance of marital imagery there. Through the prophet Hosea and his wife, we see the working out of the marital difficulties of God and Israel because of the idolatry that the Israelites are engaging in, and that is compared to unfaithfulness in a marriage. Jeremiah uses similar imagery. Isaiah does in numerous places, and that gets carried over into Christian literature. The book of Revelation describes the ultimate consummation of things as the new Jerusalem, adorned as a bride coming down from the heavens, dressed in marital or wedding attire to meet the bridegroom. Closely related to all this marriage imagery in the Bible is all the vineyard imagery. If you've ever wondered why there are so many vineyard parables in the New Testament, it's because you need a lot of vineyards to support all this marriage stuff. Because, of course, you can't have weddings without wine. Both today and tomorrow, we'll be looking at the business of the wine that's necessary for the feasts, marital and otherwise. So there's just plenty of marital imagery to work with and feasting. But today we're going to look at primarily betrothal scenes, each of which have meals. And to give you a picture of where we're going with this, ultimately what we want to be looking at, in addition to a whole bunch of other stuff about how biblical stories work, is what the cost of the marriage feast is, the feast to come, the ultimate marriage feast. What does it cost? And specifically, what does it cost God? We're going to begin back in Genesis 24. This is a long story, and I spent too long on it in the 7:45 version of this session this morning, and I ended up running overtime, so we're going to do this story very quickly in hit-and-run style, virtually. It's the story of Abraham dispatching one of his servants to find a wife for his son Isaac. He wants Isaac to have a wife who will be from his own people, not a wife from among the foreigners. And so he sends this servant off with directions to get a woman from his own homeland. He sends the servant with lots of wealth, camels loaded up with all manner of gold and fine things. The servant prays to God on his way that he would meet a woman when he comes to a well where he will water his camels, and that the sign for the right woman that he should ask to take back to Isaac would be that the woman would not only offer him a drink, but would offer to give the camels a drink as well. And so he does then arrive at a well, and immediately there comes Rebekah, the daughter of Laban, to the well, and she not only offers him a drink, but says, "I'd be happy to give your camels water as well." And he is so grateful. This is the answer to his prayer. So he speaks to her and asks her who she is. She runs home to get Laban, says, "I've met this man." He comes out. He is most intrigued when he sees all the gold. And if you know anything about Laban, you know exactly what's going to hook him. And he is very interested, invites the man to come stay with him. And so the servant comes and tells Laban this whole story about how he's been sent and how he prayed, how the answer to his prayer happened there at the well. And so this was meant to be. And finally, at the end of the story, we've got everybody in agreement. The prayer has been answered. Laban is in agreement. The servant is in agreement. But the one thing they still need is they have to ask Rebekah, who has the final word, in verse 57. They said, "We will call the girl and ask her." And they called Rebekah and said, "Will you go with this man?" And then everyone holds their breath. It doesn't say that in the text, but you have to read that in there. "I will," she says. A very critical moment. So they sent her away. They sent their sister and her nurse along with Abraham's servant. They blessed Rebecca, and along with her maids, she mounted the camels. And in verses 62 and following, she meets Isaac back there in the country of Abraham and Sarah, and they become husband and wife. Okay. Without further ado, let's look at the next such story, which is in Genesis 29, and then we'll talk a little bit about these stories. In the next generation, Isaac and Rebekah's son Jacob is out of his home territory for various reasons, including the fact that he is fleeing from the murderous threats of his brother, whom, along with his mother, he has tricked out of the family blessing. And as Jacob is on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east, same place where his father, his bride, came from, he looked, he saw a well in the field and three flocks of sheep lying there beside it, for out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said, "My brothers, where do you come from?" They said, "Haran." He said, "Do you know Laban?" They said, "We do." He said, "Is it well with him?" "Yes," they replied, "and here's his daughter Rachel coming with the sheep." He said, "Look, it's broad daylight. It's not the time for animals to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them." But they said, "We can't until all the flocks are gathered and the stone is rolled away." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of his mother's brother Laban, and the sheep of his mother's brother Laban, he went up and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock. Now, this is the stone that it usually took three different groups to move. And he rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of his mother's brother Laban. Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman. Excuse me, I skipped the most important verse. He kissed Rachel and wept aloud and told her who he was. She ran and told her father. When Laban heard the news, he ran to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him home. They talk. And he says, "What can I give you?" And he said, "Well, I'd love to have your daughter, Rachel. I'd work for 7 years for her. Okay?" And they make a deal. And as we all know, of course, it gets somewhat complicated by the fact that Laban puts Leah into the tent on the wedding night, and it results in 7 more years of labor and so forth. Okay, a quite similar story. Let's keep going through one more, and then we'll figure these out as a group. Exodus chapter 2. Verses 15 and following is where we'll focus. Moses is on the lam. He has killed an Egyptian slave master and is on Pharaoh's wanted list. And while in flight out in the land of Midian, verse 15, he sat down by a well. Well, we already know what's going to happen to him. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock, but some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and came to their defense and watered their flock, and they returned to their father Reuel, and he said, "How is it that you come back so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian helped us against the shepherds, even drew water for us and watered the flocks." He said, "Well, where is he? Why'd you leave him out there? Invite him to break bread." So they obviously went and got him. Moses agreed to stay with the man. He gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore a son, named him Gershom. So in 6 verses, a very compact version of the same outline. We've seen in 60-some verses, and then 20-some verses, and now 6 verses. Israelite man traveling outside homeland comes to a well, meets a woman or women at the well. An exchange of water takes place at a certain time of day. Woman runs home to tell family, "I've met this man." Family members say, "Well, bring him home." They bring the man for hospitality. They talk. Man leaves with bride. Exactly the same sequence. Moral of the story is, if you are an Israelite traveling outside home, be careful at the wells. You won't leave unattached.
Where
is that well? Well, my Bible has maps. Back here. We'll talk later. In literary studies, this device is known as a type scene. That is, a scene with a common outline that happens, frequently, and readers or viewers, if this is done in a non-text form, know what this sequence is like. And the crucial thing about such a sequence are actually the differences. Everybody knows the woman at the well story, but each one has its quirks. There are other such scenes in the biblical tradition. You all know the scene where angels come and startle people, and they always say the same thing, don't they? "Be not afraid." What a thing to say. Scare people until they wet their pants and then say, "Oh, be not afraid." And so these annunciation scenes, they all have the same outline, but the differences between them are what's most important. We have them in our culture too. The one that is most common to me is from my childhood, when I used to watch early Sunday morning before church cowboy movies. Old cowboy movies. I used to think they were done in Montana, but I've seen a few of them as an adult, and now I know they were all done in the studio, because the same three rocks are in all of them. But every one of these movies ended the same way. They all ended up in Main Street with two men, several paces apart, ready to do this draw thing where they were going to, one of them was going to end up dead and the other would be the winner. And you always figured, well, the good guy will win somehow, but we don't know how. And so that same type scene gets acted over and over again, but they all have, what's crucial about them is how they are different. Because sometimes the sheriff has only one arm and has to use a special kind of gun, and it surprises the other guy and he doesn't know what to make of this. Or sometimes the sheriff is a chicken. And so somebody from up there in the window shoots the bad guy, but everybody thinks it was the sheriff, And now he's got credibility. Or whatever. There's always some curious difference depending upon the particular characters and the way this story has gone. Well, that's what's going on here. What's different about each of these stories is a clue to the overall meaning of things for this particular character. So just with these three so far, if you take the basic outline as Israelite man traveling in foreign land meets woman at a certain time of day and exchange water at a well, she runs home, tells family, they bring the man home, talk, and ultimately results in betrothal. What's the unusual feature of the Isaac-Rebecca story? or what are the unusual features?
The mind isn't here, the white man.
All right, the man is not there. Somebody sent, a servant is sent instead. All right.
His purpose that time was to find a wife. He went out to look for a wife. The other.
Okay. All right. This was very purposeful, not a chance thing that happens in the others.
Is prayer to God at the beginning to guide his choice?
Okay. We definitely have God arranging this one. God is brought in as actively involved in the choice.
And I like the little test that the servant gave in the beginning, because that was a good little test to give in his prayer, because here comes this gal who obviously is a thoughtful, sensitive lady.
Okay.
And in the second one, she's just beautiful.
Ah, all right. Okay.
Rachel gets asked for her opinion.
Okay. Rebecca.
Rebecca.
Yeah.
Rebecca gets asked.
Right. And the story, everybody's got everything figured out, but it can't happen until they ask her. She finally has the last word. I will. Okay, think about the life of Isaac and Rebecca. How does the story reflect? I mean, their story isn't very long in some ways compared to, the other Genesis ancestral stories. But, Isaac, passive person all the way through. He is hauled up to Moriah to be killed. The active person in the story of his adult life is Rebecca. She calls the shots. He is passive. He's blind through most of the story that we're aware of. And Rebecca is the one who makes things happen. Rebecca, by the way, means noose. Rivka is the Hebrew word for a trap made out of rope with which you captured things. So it means, and I named my daughter Rebecca, and I teach Hebrew, so I knew what it meant. It's an endearing word. It means a person with charm that captivates. But Rebecca is also a person in whose rope everybody else is caught in Genesis. She's in charge. She loves Jacob more than Esau, the older, and so she sees to it that her beloved ends up with the blessing. She's in control in this family. She has the last word, even as she did in the betrothal scene. Jacob? How is Jacob's story at the well like his life? He comes there, it's a little too early for watering. Usually takes three groups of shepherds to move this stone, but Jacob sees Rachel and instantly has an attack of what my sister calls the DTPs, deadly testosterone poisoning. And he's going to move this rock.
His birthright, and then he ends up having to serve another 7 years to get the woman that he really loved.
Yeah, Jacob and Laban are a match. Jacob means, it's not quite he cheats, but close, He gets his name from the fact that his brother came out first, but he was grabbing hold of his brother trying to get him back in there and get out first. So the trickster, the one who will get you if you don't watch out, is what Jacob's name means. But he has to work so hard to get his well story accomplished, and that's the story of his life. He has to work so long for Rachel, and he has to work so long for Laban before he can finally go back home. Moses, how is Moses' story like the rest of his life? Moses is the deliverer of his people, right? And he begins, or in his well story, he delivers these women from these hostile shepherds. And in fact, one of the verbs in Hebrew in Exodus 2, where it says in English, at least in my NRSV, he came to their defense. The Hebrew verb yasha, the word for saving, is the verb there. He saved them and watered their flocks. And Moses becomes known as the savior of his people. So each one of these stories somehow or another foreshadows major roles that the characters in them will play and launches them into their careers or into their lives, into their roles. Now there are other such stories in the Hebrew Bible and variations on them. One of them is the book of Ruth, in which you have a kind of mirror image of these things. Here now you have a foreign woman coming from outside to the homeland of the Israelites. She links up with the workers of this fellow Boaz, and Boaz tells her, when you need water, my fellows will get some for you from the well. Don't worry about it. That she is invited in for a meal with the workers, and she is given food and wine, and then she ends up wife of Boaz. Okay, so this is this is another betrothal scene with the same elements. It almost happens for Saul, the first king, very early in Saul's career in 2 Samuel 9. Saul is traveling outside of his usual territory, and he comes to a place where some women are headed for a well to draw water. And instead of asking them for water, he says, have you seen the seer, the prophet? They said, oh yeah, he's somewhere over there. And he, instead of staying for water, he goes off on this wild goose chase and ends up making some big mistakes. And of course, we all know what became of Saul. He sort of made this king thing work, but not completely, and it all fell apart. Well, he should have stuck at the well. You know, his story got short-circuited, and he ended up on a wild goose chase. So, and there are people who don't have these. Now, you'd expect that someone like David would have one of these, but he doesn't. That's because David went around collecting women. He doesn't. And frankly, he doesn't earn one of these stories. All right, without further ado, let's go to the one that's in the New Testament, which is in John chapter 4. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, he left Judea and started back to Galilee. But he had to go through Samaria, so he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon, and a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." Da 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 da. If Jesus has been reading his Bible, he should know better than to, you know, he should know better than to sit down by a well in a foreign land unless he was ready for this. Okay.
Maybe that's why the disciples were so upset.
Yeah, if they've been reading their Bibles, and they said, "Wait a minute, Jesus." The reader is ready for this, however. The narrator has prepared the reader for this back in chapter 3, in the paragraph in verses 25 to 30, in the discussion with John the Baptist. And some who thought John the Baptist might be the Messiah are put straight when John says in verse 28 and following, "You yourselves are my witnesses that I said I'm not the Messiah, but I've been sent ahead of him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. For this reason, my joy has been fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease." So there you have it. John the Baptist is the best man. The bridegroom is coming soon. I can hear his voice. And in chapter 4, he appears. So, he sits at the well at noon. And when the Samaritan woman came to draw water, he said, "Give me a drink." The woman asked him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" For Jews don't share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you'd have asked him and he'd give you living water." The woman said, "You don't even have a bucket. And the well is deep. Where are you going to get that living water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us this well and with his sons and flocks drank from it?" Jesus said, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said, "Give me this water so I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming back here to this well." Jesus said, "Go call your husband and come back." The woman said, "I have no husband." Jesus said, "Right. You've had 5 husbands and are now with one who's not your husband." The woman said, "I see you are a prophet." And then they have this conversation about worship on this mountain as opposed to the mountain where the Jews worship. Jesus identifies himself finally as the Messiah. And the disciples then show up in verse 27, ask what in the world is going on. Verse 28, the woman left her water jar, went back to the city and said to people, "Come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done. Could it be that he's the Messiah?" They left the city and were on their way to him. The disciples then have this conversation with him about what's been going on. Jump to verse 39. Many Samaritans came, believed in him because of the woman's testimony. When the Samaritans came, they asked him to stay with them. And he stayed there 2 days, and many believed because of his word. And when the 2 days were over, verse 43, he went from that place to Galilee. And then come some other stories. All right, same outline as these other stories. Traveling outside the homeland, meets a woman at a well, and so forth. Woman runs home, invite Jesus in. What are the differences that characterize this story, which launched Jesus, foreshadow his life?
He doesn't get married.
All right, he leaves without a bride. So this one is incomplete. we'll figure out where it gets complete in a little bit. But that's one thing that's crucial. This one is not yet finished.
They don't mention her beauty or her thoughtfulness or her generosity.
All right, in all the other stories, this woman is either beautiful, fair to look upon, and a virgin whom no man has ever known, or whatever. We aren't told much about Zipporah or the daughters of Reuel, but what is the character of this woman? All right, not only is she a foreigner, she's had five husbands. The Torah allows three. So she's had more husbands than the Torah allows. Not that, you know, Samaritans had their own Torah, but, you know, even their Torah didn't allow that. Okay, so you have this woman who's
an outcast.
Okay, she's an outcast. She's been through lots in her life. What else is different besides the character of the woman?
The one that she gives is not as good as the stuff he has.
Okay, they get to comparing drinks.
she doesn't want to give it to him. In all the other stories, they're glad to.
Yeah. And indeed, he does not get a drink. He asked for a drink, and he didn't get one. We could say that she did get some of this living water because she ends up with her life changed by her relationship now to him as Messiah. But he didn't get a drink. That's why he sat down there in the first place.
She challenges him verbally.
Yeah, this is a challenging conversation instead of a compliance, as happens in all the others. Well, how are these things like the rest of the story of Jesus in John? Does Jesus get his drink ever, or his bride in John's gospel? Well, remember what time it was? The timing is always important. It was not the time for watering in some of those stories. At other times, Reuel asked, "Why are you back so soon? Aren't we a little ahead of schedule here today?" You know. In this story, it's noon. Lots have always made of that by the commentators. And they suggest that that polite people, especially women, only came to the well early in the morning or early in the evening, in the cool of the day, partly because of the heat, but partly because the rest of the day men hung around the wells, and for a woman to come to a well in the middle of the day was inappropriate. Or as I once heard it put, if you came to a well in the middle of the day, what you expected to take home, you couldn't take home in a bucket. So that's all. She's all, you know, aspersions are always cast upon this woman because she's there in the middle of the day. But I don't know that that's why that's important. Because later on in John's gospel, there is another time when precisely at noon he asks for a drink. On the cross in John. In the other Gospels, he's crucified at 9 in the morning. But in John, he is crucified at noon. And in John, he asks for a drink. John 19, verses 28 and following. After this, when Jesus knew that all was now finished, he said, in order to fulfill the scripture, I am thirsty, or I thirst, as we usually hear it. A jar full of sour wine was standing there, so they put a sponge full of the wine on a branch of hyssop and held it to his mouth. And when Jesus had received the wine, he said, "It is finished," and bowed his head and gave up his spirit. That drink means a lot of things in John's gospel. First of all, in John, it's Passover. And this is a Passover cup. It's also in John that Jesus speaks of the cup that the Father has asked him to drink, and he will drink it willingly. It is the cup of death. And he drinks that cup, and now it's finished. It's also his coronation cup. John's crucifixion scene is a coronation scene in which, by the order of Pontius Pilate, spokesman of the empire, Jesus is made the new emperor. And this is the cup of coronation. But it's also his wedding cup. The drink that he receives, John describes as a drink of, my Bible says, sour wine. Most of your Bibles probably say vinegar. The Greek word is oxus, which refers not to, the Greek word for regular wine is oinos, which is good wine. Oxus is cheap wine, the kind of stuff that soldiers carried around and you took when you were traveling because you didn't want to drink the water from the creeks because you'd get that stuff, you know. So this was around, and they gave him a drink of this, but it so happens that that very drink is the drink in one of the betrothal stories of the Old Testament, the one in Ruth, where you have another foreign woman. When she gets her betrothal meal in Boaz's household, she gets a drink of chometz in Hebrew, which you translate into Greek, oxus, not oinos. So he gets his betrothal drink on the cross, and then he says, "It's finished." So the ending of his betrothal, he gets his bride on the cross. This is the cost, the way John sees it, of the betrothal meal or the wedding feast. And in Johannine literature, of course, the consummation of this is seen in Revelation, at the wedding feast in Revelation 21. And who is the bride? Well, that Samaritan woman, she stands for all of us. We are the bride of Christ in the Johannine literature. We are the New Jerusalem. And we, men and women, come adorned as the New Jerusalem, bride in bridal attire to meet the bridegroom. And like our sister, the woman of Samaria, we have been around the block. Five or more times. I have back in my files at home a collection of marriage stuff that I use when I teach this at the university, but I didn't bring it. But I have most of it memorized. So I know the stories of some of the marriages of this woman, our sister, and ourselves. One of the things in my files is a piece from the want ads in the local newspaper back home, where you can get a free want ad if you want to sell anything at all for under $50. It's called the Nifty 50 column. And one day I was reading the Nifty 50 column, and under stereo speakers and wash machine and stuff came wedding bands, matched pair, like new, used 30 days. $25 for one, $40 for both, 9-carat gold. Now, wouldn't you like to know that story? Or no, we wouldn't, I guess, want to know that story. I've got a story about a truck driver in Italy who was tipped off by one of his buddies about a prostitute that he really would have a great time with. And when he went to the brothel at the arranged time and was put or let into the room, there was his wife, housewife by day, high-priced prostitute by night. As you might guess, he beat her up, got arrested for that. I have another one that tells of a couple, man 72, woman 68, married 40 years, got into a fight over the volume of the television set. She hit him in the face with a shoe. He strangled her to death, covered her with an Afghan, and went to bed. Police came, talked to the neighbors, who said they fought a lot. This was not a happy situation. 40 years. Have another one, which is an anonymous, not anonymous, it's a letter dated in 1943 from an Arkansas woman to the draft board in her county, certifying that her husband did indeed support the family, and since he was going to go into the military, she needed assistance. And she wrote, Dear U.S. Army, my husband can't read, so don't tell him, just take him. He ain't good for nothing but shooting squirrels and drinking lemon essence. Maybe you can do something with him. I need the money. But they're not all that difficult. I'll conclude with the fifth one. I mean, the fifth of these marriages is a letter to Ann Landers. Dear Ann, my wife and I have been married for 30 years, and it's been a wonderful marriage. We love each other very much, but there's one thing I must tell you that's been driving me crazy over the years, and I do not know what to do. On our wedding night, my wife got out from her luggage an accordion that I never knew she owned, and she proceeded to play Lady of Spain and some surprisingly ribald lyrics of a couple of other English songs, and they are the only three songs that she knows. And she plays these songs almost every night. And our social life consists of only two friends, Bernice and Murray, who come over to our house, and my wife plays her accordion, and Bernice and Murray accompany. Bernice clacks two spoons together, and Murray knocks on his head and changes the tone by the pitch by opening and closing his mouth. And I'm afraid I can't take it anymore. Ann, what should I do? And Ann's response is, dear, I think the signature was Lost in Long Island. Dear Lost in Long Island, please don't ruin 30 years of sainthood by losing your temper over this now. My suggestion is that you buy your wife some sheet music to increase her repertoire. And then the last sentence is, I'm sorry, I don't know what to tell you about Bernice and Murray. So that file of stuff I have leads me to say about us what Garrison Keillor says about us in his motto for Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, which is Somus Quod Somus. We are who we are. Yeah, and that's who we are. Those stories are the way life is around us, and we all have our own versions of those, some of them more or less colorful. And yet, we are the bride of Christ. At the cost of what we see in John 19, Christ drinks the cup that makes us, even as we are, his bride. The bell is 2 minutes early. I'm sorry. Any quick questions or comments? Or I always go right up to the end, and having intended to leave time. So. No? All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll.